This is a reading from the Albigen Papers by Richard Rose. This is from the second paper, section titled The Mind, Some Observations. My quibble with modern psychology is that it not only poses with inquisitional authority, but also reneges on the basic job of at least approaching the mind. It tries to make of psychology a materialistic and mechanistic science, and in the ensuing efforts aborts the very meaning of psychology. It now investigates only protoplasmic and sensory reactions. The physical senses are part of the body, which is visible, while the mind and its projections are not. Of course, the modern psychologist gets around this by issuing an encyclical. Either the mind is physical or it does not exist. End quote. Either the body is part of our environment and is independent of the mind, or else this observer is merely a chance evolution of flab with some really fanciful concepts about himself. If memory is synaptic, we must re-examine our hopes for immortality or be prepared to settle for immortality that carries with it no memory of living. Likewise, if memory is something chemical in the chromosomes or cell nuclei, we are in a bad way at the termination of those cells. I should say, if memory is contained only in the cells, we are in a bad way. The mechanics of cell memory have not been determined with precision. We have known for a long time that the genes were memory pads, but they were thought to be only genetic memory records and had nothing to do with the memories of current happenings. This evidence, cell memory, helps us to understand that thinking is not limited to the head. And the possibility remains that the mind, rather than being completely somatic or confined to the head, is in essence with contact points in various points of the body, but without limits to that body in consideration of form, mass, or tenuosity. The science of psychology is an attempt to pay its way, leaned lately to the therapeutic or exigent approach. It concentrated upon a utilitarian enterprise that experimented with physical media and which brought forth answers, chiefly behavioristic. These findings were limited in that they related only to, or mostly to, those media. The investigations of such media are worthwhile in that some search is better than no search, but they should be classified according to their limitations. They are the study of the actions and reactions of physical bodies chiefly. It is doubtful if psychology as a science will ever become a study of the psyche. You cannot isolate the spirit and subject it to tests and measurements. The student who is trained from childhood to lean upon authority pays a dear price for the false pose of psychologists. Only recently have the colleges decided in a half-hearted way to enter the field of ESP. In the fall of 1958, I paid a visit to the University of Pittsburgh and talked with a professor of psychology. He viewed the field of ESP with some temerity and at the time was playing with ESP cards in one of his classes in a sort of non-committal manner. In other words, the students would have to take full blame or credit for any discoveries. There was an outspoken fear on his part of authorities. A friend of mine had been delegated to contact this man in order to persuade him to head a parapsychological research group, which had been recently endowed in San Antonio by Tom Slick. My friend's blank check and portfolio of credentials may just as well have been a cobra, to judge by the man's reaction. He had a strange solicitude for his job. Who are these mysterious authorities? Why must dedicated research first be cleared by politicians and religionists? Are we to presume that truth may not be divulged or approached except in a prescribed and arduous manner? Occultists have known for centuries that telepathy existed, and that faculty was perhaps more important than the more evident five senses. Yet mankind had to wait for the scientific world to partially free itself from the controls of the witch doctor and the prelate. And here, as late as 1958, we find science still trembling like a child at the woodshed door. This trembling child that may be allowed to send you to the electric chair with his definitions of your sanity. It is demonstrable to a degree that there is another sense which has more direct access to the mind than through the computer, which is largely a physical apparatus. It has been found that while the functions of the five senses depend upon a well-functioning physical body, eyes without cataracts, etc., the functioning of this outer or other sense seems to be independent of the body's health or well-being. In fact, in some cases, the new sense functions better when the body is ill, almost to the point of death, under extreme alkaline or acid shock, wasted from fasting or disease, or largely inhibited by prolonged meditation. We should not confuse the phenomena of such a sense with the mind itself. And this sixth sense, while being tactically superior to physical senses, still has its limitations. However, there is evidence to demonstrate that some of the limitations of the sixth sense are removed by practice, as experiments have shown with the use of ESP cards and dice. Accuracy increases with practice. With clairvoyance, however, there are discrepancies which no amount of practice seem to remove. This does not imply that the mind, the clairvoyance mind, involved was in error, but that either its faculty of ESP has some difference or limitation, or that the source of clairvoyant information, spirits or entities, contained factors not yet fully explored by us. Modern psychologists label most of clairvoyant observations product of mental aberrations. Like the priestcraft of old, what they did not think of first must come from the devil. We have many accounts of people who claim to have visited heaven or to have seen God. Examples are found in the testimony of world prophets, life stories of Catholic saints, medical records of cases of persons revived from near death, testimony of spiritualistic materializations, these latter give testimony only about their heaven, and of course, tales of certain mystics. In some respects, the medical cases are more evidential in that the records are of people who did not approach death with the idea of returning to testify, while the evidence brought to us by mystics is of a deliberate nature. The mystic, in so seeking, qualified the results of his findings, since minds have been known to create desired results. I hope that it has been demonstrated that there are illusions in the physical world. The statement that illusions exist implies that there is a true state of affairs, which, when correctly seen by all, will have but one appearance. The mistake that the observer, who incidentally may well be an authority or scientist, makes is in announcing himself to be above illusion after the first trip to the optometrist. He is no longer deceived by mirages or magicians. He may even pride himself with his new perspectives, including space-time concepts and the force field concepts of matter. Our space-time concepts imply that things may not really be as they appear to be when observed with the telescope. And force field concepts imply that a situation may exist that cannot be observed with the eye, even with the aid of a supermicroscope. The senses are consequently inadequate in these cases because they are not able to perceive the ultimate nature of objects under scrutiny. And being inadequate in these cases are no more commendable as senses than the senses that lays claim to witnessing heaven or God. The varied testimony of enraptured mystics does not imply mental aberration. The stuff was seen through a glass darkly. It is true that some of the testimony of visionaries was caused by a predisposition toward imagination, and some accounts may be deliberate lies. Some may have unconsciously copied from earlier authors. We can, however, accept that those we feel are sincere did actually witness a state of being if they attested that they did. The fact of their difference in testimony lies in the difference of the vehicles or persons observing and in their individual difference of faculty that facilitated the observation. When the observer relays that information to us, we have still another refraction, depending on the limitations of language. I would say that the mind itself is not finite. I would also conclude that the perception faculties and the translation faculties are considerably finite. And there is some explanation for all of the strange and diversified evidence found in this business of heaven-seeking. Some of the phenomena may be well conjurations or creations triggered by mental tricks. Some materializations actually seen by human eye are in some ways less evidential than other concepts because they have been conjured up, ordered, so to speak, as you would order bacon and eggs in a restaurant. Eliphas Levi gives us a hint of this mechanism when he describes the materialization of Apollonius of Tyana. Deeper investigation of spiritualism infers with a degree of justice that the phenomena of ectoplasmic figures are of human creation, being an emanation from the body of the medium, and being subject to certain intellectual limitations relative to the limitations of the mind of the medium and his circle. It is also believed that the mechanics of the seance are engineered by entities. William Crookes was supposed to have had a Titania for a pet. It has been my privilege to meet one of those entities, and it was quite the opposite of a Titania. So there must be other types as well. We come now to the business of entities, demons, or angels. They may or may not have substance. It depends upon the amount of substance we claim for ourselves. When we begin to concede that we, as far as our physical aspects are concerned, are to a degree illusory, then we may assume that these other entities may be to a degree illusory. But we should not assume them to be illusory just because it is not convenient to try to identify them. We can take accounts from the Tibetan Book of the Dead and find that the book warns of impressive encounters after death with alarming, if not terrifying, entities. The book wishes us to note that when these things are encountered, they signify that we are still in transition and not yet fully liberated from illusion. From what we read of Aleister Crowley, he was really not too happy with his discoveries up until the time of his death. Yet his metaphysical career started off with the conjuration of a swarm of demons in a drug-drenched experiment. With easy access to definitely supernatural acquaintances, the prospect of tapping those acquaintances for supernatural information immediately suggests itself. However, the last moments of Crowley signify that his demon friends were lacking as informants. Eliphas Levi, after spending many years in the art of conjuration, is supposed to have had disillusionment that resulted in his return to the religion of his youth. It may well be that travel to another planet and the consequent study of its people or beings may be similar in value to the study of demons. It is strictly a matter of objective. We may discover that those beings are of another dimension or rate, but not necessarily of a dimension more real than our own here in the human bodies. The worth of contact with demons is questionable in the light of all the information gathered from them. We come to another type of visitation, the projection. This is a form of phantom projected by another intelligence, perhaps human or perhaps supernatural. Under this heading come the visitations of witchcraft and some magical rites. The inference here is that this type of being has no existence other than mental. They are created by one mind to influence another. Recently, an article appeared in a magazine titled, "Does Telepathy Cause Insanity?" The psychologist who took note of this particular phenomenon was gingerly introducing the idea in the form of a question. I went to school with a man who was convinced that he was God, Jesus Christ to be exact. He became convinced of this, he told me with candor, because of voices from beings that spoke to him and addressed him as Jesus. The man was, to all appearances, a sane man. He was a homosexual, and he tried to copy that which he thought to be the physical appearance of Jesus. He was no apparent lunatic. In college, he was an astute mathematician, and by avocation, he was a skilled fundamentalist. He was very practical, except on the subject of his own divinity and on the insistence that he had a vast telepathic following. He had that which the minister in Graveside Eulogy referred to as a subtle sense of humor. Incidentally, he believed that he would never die because he believed in himself. The mental institutions are filled with people who hear voices and see people and animals quite invisible to the attendants. Yet these same insane people occasionally come up with startling announcements. At one time in Russia, about the same time that the Starets Rasputin came into prominence, there was widespread reverence for idiots that bordered on worship. It was supposed that the miserable condition of the idiots was the price paid for their unusual contact with higher dimensions. I was startled a few years back by a young neighbor who had been released from a mental institution only a few days prior to the following incident. He sat beside me in my kitchen. Our wives were, for the moment, monopolizing the conversation. Without facing me or even looking at me, he read my mind aloud. I thought to myself, "He is reading my mind." He half turned and commented, "I have been able to do that ever since I have been a child." These were not his only words. He replied for several minutes to my thoughts and replied in depth, being fully aware of things I knew but did not speak. Nor did I even answer him at the end. I was too surprised. This particular man claimed to have seen God, but God appeared to him in human form. He once mistook the family physician for God and knelt prayerfully before him. The physician, who had recently recovered himself from a nervous breakdown, became alarmed and ushered the patient out of his office. The result was an institution for the patient. The man who thought he was Jesus had been committed once to an institution. He was picked up for walking in the streets of a small town dressed in burlap while preaching the gospel. He could laugh while describing the experience. I asked him about his relief from the asylum. "Heaven knows it was a task," he smiled as he replied. I never knew before that I was an actor until that time, nor did I know the full insidiousness of society and of those in charge of saying what insanity is. Heavens, yes, it was the best acting I had ever done in my life. I had to act sane, and if you have never tried acting sane, you must try it sometime, especially when you have to guess what they mean by saneness. What will pass the board? You learn after a while that sanity is basic harmlessness, industriousness, and gregariousness. You have to put the idea out of your head that you are just a plain, hard-working chap without a brain in your head, and they will let you go. It is easy to frighten them, and you must not do that. Questions frighten them, as do metaphors and harmless equations. They pretend to be thoroughly logical in their interrogation, but it is strictly instinctive. If you manifest logic yourself, they will manifest fear immediately. I rather think they are afraid of a reversal of positions if the logical communication is encouraged. Swedenborg was considered insane by his contemporaries. He knew St. Paul and most of the apostles rather intimately, according to his writings. He had not only visited heaven, but hell as well. His description of those two regions was predominantly one of an objective experience as distinguishable from the more subjective experiences of other mystics whose experiences or ecstasies led them to proclaim heaven to be a state of being for the mind or a state of rapport of the mind with a more extensive being or mind stuff. Swedenborg described not a state of being, but a place visited by beings. Swedenborg was not too reliable as a witness about other matters on which he spoke with authority. He had written scientific treatises years before becoming a mystic, and in one of his scientific books he proclaimed that the moon was a mirror. He also claimed to have intimate knowledge of being on other planets. We can note without prejudice that his faculty of perception, which he extols as being extrasensory, was not infallible, and was in fact laden with error. Swedenborg is no reason for a wholesale rejection of all accounts of experiences of mystics. And records by celebrated prophets and religionists are not more valid than the information gathered from individuals who have had unusual experiences and who make no great fuss about them. The words of a drunk, a dope addict, or a social derelict are as valid as any other if we are gathering material for the study of the human mind. The prophet, in fact, may have weighed his words, while the unimportant habitue of the public square may have nothing to gain and less to hide than most of us. I have recently read a book, Modern Clinical Society, by A.P. Noyes. He tells us much about mental diseases, but does not give us a definition of the mind. In this book of mine, it would be impossible to bring to account every other book on the matter of psychology. It suffices to say that I have never found one that properly defines the mind. Noyes avoids that definition until he can smother us with a hanging garden of Babel. He then decides, it will be noted that in the definition of psychiatry and its discussion as a branch of biology, there was no mention of the word mind. There need not, however, be any objection to the use of the word, provided it is employed as a collected designation for all those activities and phenomena that occur when the organism functions as a whole and that represent the product of interactions between it and the environment. If you think that was confusing, he elucidates in the same paragraph and utters an awesome decree like the witch doctor of old. That which the witch doctor does not know does not exist. The degree is in essence a mandate for religion. Man is monistic. Man has no indwelling soul. Man has to be the soul or nothing. He also abandons the whole field of mind study for the safer ground of what might be called mechanistic observations. I quote him, As a corollary to this definition of mind, the reactions of parts of the organism would be designated as physiological. Mind is therefore the biological expression of the organism responding to its own needs and to the stresses of the environment. Man is a unitary organism or being whose physical, mental, emotional, and social reactions constitute but different aspects of one individual whole which function as a unit. The mind, therefore, is but one of the biological characteristics or functions of the organism and not an entity having an existence parallel with the body. If you read that the same as I do, this fellow does not believe that the mind is anything but the factory control room. You will see a parallel to a degree in the concept which I offer that draws a picture of illusioned man possessing capacity for reaction more than for will. Man does react, and modern psychiatry is biological in its scope, but psychiatry is not then a science of the psyche. This man Noyes is more of a biological mechanic, an electrician skilled in knowing brain areas that are likely to be undercharged or overcharged in the cases of varying symptoms and irregularities of behavior. He tells us that exaltation, his word for ecstasy, is a proper diagnosis for the state of mind, that's body-mind, evinced by Buddha, Saint Teresa, John of the Cross, and any of the other raptured mystics. The millions of followers of these mystics must then be psychotic. Yet he defines abnormality or undesirable functioning as that which disturbs the subjective state of the individual or his relations with other persons. The serenity of the mystic surely is not a disturbance to his subjective state. And the history of mystics shows that after they reached the exaltation, they were more acceptable than before. The most harmless being on earth is a mystic. We can note the acceptance of Jesus and Buddha. We may note here that Noyes relates that which is psychotic to that which is not desired by other people. Sanity is once more a matter of public mandate, not scientific proof. The psychiatrist, having no intuition, has no qualification for piddling with the minds of other men. Unfortunately, it is important only that he helps to build a new infallible priestcraft for the courtroom intercourse with the legal profession. And it seems not important that he is not able to help a person who comes to him with a sickness that is intangible as far as a biological examination might show. How would he treat a case of possession? With shock treatments or exorcism? Never exorcism. How would he treat a case of mediumship? To him, of course, the medium is schizophrenic, and to some psychiatrists, telepathy itself is only a hallucination. It does not matter to them that the medium or recipient of telepathic messages may have data produced that bear no relation to any prior knowledge or experiences of their lives, nor to knowledge of things happening even as the medium is speaking. This is in reference to astral projection or its equivalent. We must keep our eye on oversimplifying method of modern psychologists. Psychiatrists are simply mechanics, somatic electricians. It is true that they observe behavior and have experimented with methods and gadgets to alter that behavior to please society or its herd bosses. But watch these gadgets. They include tree panning and ice picking, pills of questionable after effects, and mild electrocution for mild resistance and permanent electrocution for stubborn resistance. There are some cases where such a mechanic is useful, but we must always keep in mind that this mechanic who treats our body voltage still knows nothing about the essence of the electricity of that body. No man can lay claim to being a psychiatrist until he has learned the trick of stepping into the mind of the other, to think for a while with his thoughts. And any other pretensive approach is peripheral. We should therefore not hurry to define the mind, but honestly try to enter it. To be an authority on life on the moon is expedited best by going there, not by resorting to scientific daydreams. If the body is the totality of man, it certainly has subtler extensions not visible to the eye. I believe that the computer is perishable. I believe that most insanity, or that which is diagnosed as insanity, is physical derangement or an incompatibility or impairment of parts by disease, aging, or accident. The case histories of many people who have been cured or who have recovered from that which the medical profession labeled as insanity show that they were aware of their affliction at the time of their insanity, even though they were unable to communicate to others. I believe that this detached witness to this suffering is the mind. It is the final individual observer. It is not the final mind, however. The individual mind may yet have contact or union with other mind substance. The body is the observer, but it is not the final observer. We could accept that memory is chemical, synaptic, or genetic, chromosomic, and we would still not account for the memories transmitted by telepathy. We may refer to them as mind pictures, but they are still memories once pictured. We can readily admit that the five senses will decay someday, but we do not know if that other sense, the telepathic sense, or sixth sense, will decay. The body, which is like an electrical generator, someday will lose its voltage. That is true. But the relation of that voltage, in any instance, to the final observer is not yet established. As we have seen, many of the desired phenomena, such as Satori, occur when the voltage is very low or when the wires are badly crossed or shorted out. From my own personal experience, I have that which may be to the reader a strange conviction. I cannot offer it with any posed proof. It must be taken as just a case history for what it's worth. My comprehension of the mind of the final observer is such that it presumes that the observer to have neither need of mundane perception or memory to be. It has a different perspective when the body is negated or removed, in that it no longer particularizes, for one thing. The memories and the personality that we identified as being us in the body, quote, have ultimately about the same dearness and wistfulness as the characters from a story projected upon a screen for our edification. It might be like coming out of such a dark theater, out of comfort and illusion, this business of finding our real selves. For a short while, the chilly shock of the out-of-doors reality is there.